I thought I have finished with the passage, but still there is something that I want to talk about. So we will go back to the phrase removing covetousness and greed in the world. We understand from the two phrases, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, and removing covetousness and greed in the world, that we must make effort and we must try to be mindful. And when our mindfulness becomes strong, we will see the objects clearly, we will see the true nature of things, and at the same time, we remove the covetousness and greed, or we remove the mental defilements. When we understand this much, we are happy and we are pleased with ourselves. But ancient teachers went deeper than just this much understanding. The commentary pointed out to us that the phrase removing covetousness and greed in the world shows more than what we call it, more than say it appears to us. The commentary said that by this phrase, Buddha pointed out to us the power of a yogi, the ability of a yogi. And there are two mental states that are removed, then they are covetousness and greed. So there are two mental states that are removed, and by the removing of covetousness, or say, let us just call attachment, by the removing of attachment, Buddha meant the removing of satisfaction rooted in bodily gratification. That means when our body is in good shape, when we are healthy, when we are strong, and when the body is beautiful, then we are satisfied with the body. That is, if we do not practice mindfulness. If we practice mindfulness, we will be able to remove that satisfaction rooted in the bodily gratification. And by removing of greed, Buddha meant the removing of dissatisfaction rooted in bodily misfortune. That means when our body is not in good shape, when we are sick, when we have pain, and when we are ugly, we are dissatisfied with our body. But when we practice mindfulness meditation, we are able to remove or avoid dissatisfaction rooted in bodily misfortune. So, by the phrase removing covetousness and greed, Buddha meant the removing of satisfaction rooted in the bodily gratification and removing of dissatisfaction rooted in bodily misfortune. Again, by removing of covetousness or attachment, Buddha meant the removing of delight in the body. Now, people take delight in the body, and taking delight in the body is more pronounced now than ever before. Now, there are many fitness centers in this country, and people are going to these centers and taking exercises, paying a lot of money. And they go to these centers not just to be healthy, they go there to have a beautiful body. And then they are taught to love their body, to be pleased with their body. So there is the delight in the body. And delight in the body means attachment to the body. But when a person practices mindfulness or vipassana meditation, and when he is able to remove attachment, that means he is removing that delight in the body. Will such people want to practice contemplation of the body meditation? Contemplation of the body means contemplating on the different parts of the body, trying to see the body as impermanent and so on, and also trying to see different parts of the body as repulsive. So such people will not want to practice contemplation on the body. But when a person practices vipassana meditation and is able to remove grief or aversion, that means he is able to remove resistance to contemplation of the body. Such a person will not refuse to practice contemplation of the body. That is because he is able to remove, or he is able to avoid aversion regarding the body. And also, this phrase shows that a yogi is able to avoid putting something unreal onto the object and taking away something real from the objects. Now, when a yogi is able to avoid attachment, that means he does not add anything unreal to the object. Now, Buddha taught that all conditioned things are impermanent, suffering, non-soul or insubstantial, and unlovely. But those who do not practice meditation think that they are permanent, good, soul or everlasting, and lovely. So, if you think something to be lovely, that means you are adding something which is unreal, according to the teaching of the Buddha, onto the object. When you are able to avoid attachment to an object, then you are able to avoid adding something unreal onto the object. So that is one kind of the power of a yogi. When a person sees an unlovely object, he does not like it. He has aversion to that object. That means he does not like it to be unlovely. He wanted it to be lovely. So that means he wants to take away something that is real, that is unloveliness, from the object. So, by being able to remove grief, a yogi is able to avoid taking something real away from the object. these three are described in the commentary as the power of a yogi. He is free from satisfaction and dissatisfaction regarding the body, and he is able to stand firm against delight and non-delight, and he is free from putting in something unreal and taking away something real. So these three are called the power of a yogi. And a yogi who possesses these three kinds of powers is called a yogi who is accomplished in meditation. When we practice meditation, it is very important that we do not add anything onto the object, and also we do not take away anything from the object. Now, if we think that a certain thing is permanent, then we are putting or adding the permanent, which is unreal, onto the object, which is impermanent. And when we want an impermanent to be permanent, that means we want to take away the impermanency, which is real, from the object. And if we add something, and if we take away something, if we add something unreal, and if we take something real from the object, then we will not see the object as it is. And so we will be carried away by liking or disliking, satisfaction or dissatisfaction, delight or non-delight regarding the objects. So vipassana gives us the power to see things as they really are, to see things without any additions, to see things without any omissions. We just take the objects as they are, and it is very important to see things as they are, so that we can avoid both attachment and aversion to the objects. And these powers mentioned in the commentary can be obtained only by those who practice vipassana meditation, only by those who make effort and who practice mindfulness and who comprehends the object clearly. So at the same time, when a yogi comprehends the objects clearly, he is able to take the object without any additions or omissions. So it is only a yogi, it is only a vipassana yogi that can take the object as it is without additions or omissions. And so it is called a power of the yogi, and a yogi who possesses this power is actually an accomplished meditator. Now we will go to the practice. Now there are some preliminary qualities to be fulfilled before a person practices meditation. And once a monk went to the Buddha and asked the Buddha to teach him in brief, so that after listening to the instructions given by the Buddha, he could go to a secluded place and practice meditation. To him, the Buddha said, "You should first purify the beginning of all wholesome things. You should first purify the beginning of all wholesome things." And what is the beginning of all wholesome things? Sila, that is well purified, or Sila, that is very pure, and the view that is straight. That means a view that is correct. When your Sila is very pure and your understanding correct, then supported and aided by Sila, you may cultivate the four foundations of mindfulness. So in this discourse, Buddha taught to that monk two things that he should practice, he should accomplish before he practiced the foundations of mindfulness. The first is very pure sila, the purity of moral conduct. And the second is the correct understanding. Although this advice is given to a monk, lay people also should follow this advice. So lay people also who want to practice meditation must fulfill these two things, the purity of moral conduct and then correct understanding. Now the purity of moral conduct is important. It is actually a basis for practice of meditation or concentration, because when the moral conduct is not pure, concentration cannot be gained. Because when moral conduct is not pure, the feeling of guilt or feeling of remorse can interfere with the practice. Say, I'm now practicing meditation and my sila is not pure. Although other people may think that I am pure in my sila, I know that I am not pure, and so on. So he criticizes himself, he blames himself, and so he is not able to concentrate on the meditation object. So if one's moral conduct is not pure, one cannot hope to attain samadhi or concentration. So that is why the purity of moral conduct or pure sila is very important. And for lay people to purify their moral conduct is not so difficult. They can take the precepts and keep them, and their moral conduct is pure. And when we look at the stories during the time of the Buddha, we see that the purity of moral conduct can be achieved just at the beginning of the practice of meditation. Now, that is why yogis are made to take precepts at the beginning of the practice. So that is to fulfill this one requirement for the practice of meditation. A minimum moral requirement for lay people is keeping five precepts. And these five precepts are called universal precepts. These precepts can be found or can be taken even when there are no Buddhas or there are no teachings of the Buddha available. So even outside the dispensation of the Buddha, it is said in our books that these five precepts were kept by lay people. So these five precepts are the minimum moral requirement for lay people, and you all know the five precepts: abstention from killing, abstention from stealing, abstention from sexual misconduct, abstention from telling lies, and abstention from taking intoxicants. So if you can abstain from these five, then your moral conduct is pure. But at this retreat, or at our retreat, yogis take eight precepts. Now, taking eight precepts and keeping them is better than taking five precepts. So taking eight precepts, yogis can avoid some unwholesome states, and also they get more time to devote to the practice. So at our retreat, eight precepts is a standard practice for all yogis. So after taking the precepts, you can rest assured that your moral conduct is pure, and so you have a firm basis for the practice of meditation. There is a question regarding the purity of moral conduct. How long must a person be pure in moral conduct before he can practice meditation? Now, many people think that moral conduct should be pure all the life, or moral conduct should be pure for a long time before they can practice meditation. And so there are many people who would say, first you purify your moral conduct, do not practice meditation yet. And they say that you have to purify your moral conduct for a long time. But that is not correct, because when we see the stories that occurred during the time of the Buddha, we know that those who are not pure in their moral conduct, after they met the Buddha and listened to the Dhamma and got enlightenment. So from these stories, we can conclude that it is not essential for a person to be pure in moral conduct for a long time before he practices meditation. Although if his moral conduct can be pure for a long time, it's very good. But sometimes people are afraid that, my moral conduct is not pure, and so I cannot practice meditation, and so they do not practice meditation, and they are deprived of this opportunity. So for lay people, to be pure in moral conduct, they just be a few moments, or a few hours, or a few days. There are many stories to show that even those who are not pure in moral conduct for a long time can gain enlightenment. I will give you only two stories. Now, during the time of the Buddha, there was a man who was fishing. On that morning, when Buddha surveyed the world with his Buddha eye, he saw this person in his mind. So in the morning, when that person was fishing, Buddha went that way on his arms round, along with his disciples. So when Buddha got near the man, the man put down the, what about that, fishing rod, and then paid respects to the Buddha. Then the Buddha asked him, "What is your name?" Then he said, "My name is Mr. Pure." Then Buddha said, "Those who kill beings, who inflict suffering on beings, are not called pure, Mr. Pure. Only those who do not inflict suffering on beings are called Mr. Pure." So after hearing this verse uttered by the Buddha, it is said in the books that he became a Sotapanna. Now, he was fishing, so his moral conduct was not pure until he met the Buddha. So after he heard the verse uttered by the Buddha, he must have made a resolution in his mind, "I will no longer do this." So when he has made this resolution in his mind, he has purified his moral conduct. So he listened to the teaching of the Buddha, and actually he went through the different stages of vipassana while he was listening to the teaching, and at the end of the teaching, then he reached Sotapannahood. He became a Sotapanna. So that is one story. So in this story, now you know that until he met the Buddha, his moral conduct was not pure. The other story is about two pickpockets. Again, during the time of the Buddha, there were two friends who were pickpockets. So one day, they went to where the Buddha was preaching to a multitude of people. So with the intention of picking a pocket or two, they entered into the audience. And one of them was able to snatch some money from a listener. But the other pickpocket got interested in the teachings of the Buddha. And so he did not snatch anything from anybody, but he listened to the Dhamma, he listened to the preaching, and at the end of that preaching, again he became a Sotapanna. In this story also, the one who became a Sotapanna, his moral conduct was not pure until he got interested in the teaching of the Buddha. So he got interested in the teaching of the Buddha, and he must have made a resolution at that moment that "I will no longer do this pickpocketing." And so he purified his sila while listening to the teaching of the Buddha. And then he may practice meditation while sitting. And so at the end of the teaching, he became a Sotapanna. So, for lay people, it is easy to purify sila or to achieve the purity of sila. No. It is good. It would be best to be pure in sila for a long time, to be pure in sila for the whole of your life. So I'm not encouraging you to be fishermen and pickpockets and then come to the center and practice meditation. But I want to let people know that even if their moral conduct was not pure in the past, still they can practice meditation, because they can purify their sila right before they sit down and practice meditation. So it is good to keep the moral conduct pure as long as you can, and it is an ideal to be pure in moral conduct. But even if you are not pure in moral conduct before, still you can you can practice meditation because you can purify your moral conduct right at the beginning of the practice. Purity of moral conduct is emphasized in the teachings of the Buddha, because purity of moral conduct leads to non-remorse. Now, if your moral conduct is not pure, you have remorseful feelings. So if your moral conduct is pure, you are free from remorse. And that freedom from remorse leads to joy, and joy leads to happiness. Happiness leads to peacefulness. Peacefulness leads to concentration, and concentration leads to seeing things as they really are. And this ultimately leads to attainment of enlightenment. So it is the moral purity of moral conduct is at the very base of the practice taught by the Buddha. And so when the monk asked him to teach in brief what he must do, Buddha said, "You purify your sila first." The second requirement Buddha taught to that monk is the view that is straight. So that means the correct view. And the correct view is explained in the commentary as the understanding that beings have karma alone as their property. Or in other words, understanding of and belief in the law of karma. And the belief in law of karma does not mean blind faith in the law of karma. It is belief founded upon understanding. Now, according to the teachings of the Buddha, there is what is called karma, and there are the results of karma. Now, when you do something, a mental state arises in the mind, a mental state that encourages you to do the deed, that urges you to do the deed. And that mental state is called volition. And when Buddha taught about karma, the Buddha meant the volition. So that mental state that arises in the mind when you do something good or something bad is called karma. And that mental state has the ability or potential to give results in the future. Mind has great power. And when mind is headed by this volition, it can give results. Now, we look at our body. If this body is connected with mind, it moves, it walks, it eats, and so on, it does many activities. Once mind is separated from the body, what happens? We are dead. So a dead body cannot even move. But a live body, a body that is alive, can do many activities. Now, this hand is rupa, this is matter. So this is heavy. Although this is heavy, the mind can make it move. Now, I have the intention to move, and so there is movement of the hand. So my movement of the hand is caused by my mind. If I do not want to move, my hand will not move. So my hand has, I mean, my mind has the power to make the hand move. Mind cannot be seen, but the hand can be seen, and it is heavy compared to mind. But with the power of mind, I can move my hand. So mind has power. And among the mental states, there is one that is called volition or karma, and that has the potential to give results in the future. And so when the, I think it's okay, when the conditions are ripe for the karma to give results, then the results are produced. So there is what we call karma, and there is what we call the results of karma. And we Buddhists believe in this law of karma. That is, there is karma, and there is the results of karma. And also we believe that good karma produces good results, and bad karma produces bad results. For Buddhists, this second requirement is not difficult, because since we are Buddhists, we already have understanding of and believe in the law of karma. But what about other people who belong to other religions? They want to practice meditation. What should we say to them? If you don't believe in the law of karma, you cannot practice meditation and turn them away. I don't want to do that. So, I may say something like this. You should have believed in the law of cause and effect, not the law of karma. I think everybody can accept this, that the law of cause and effect, because when there is a cause, there is an effect, and effect is always caused by the cause. So this relationship as cause and effect can be seen everywhere, and I think everybody can accept this. So to those who do not believe in karma, so we would say, okay, if you don't believe in karma, it's okay. But do you believe in the law of cause and effect? I think he will say yes. Then you can practice meditation. So, according to this discourse given by the Buddha, there are two preliminary requirements before one practices the foundations of mindfulness. But there are some other things also that a person should do before he practices meditation, and that is asking forgiveness. Now, we do asking forgiveness every morning. That is because it is important. Asking forgiveness is very important for a person who is practicing meditation.